Welcome to Live from the Table, the official podcast for the world famous Comedy Cellar. I'm here with Noam Dworman, the host of Live from the Table and the owner of the world famous Comedy Cellar. And we have a very special guest today. I'm reading because Dan is not with us, obviously. Michael Oren, former Israeli ambassador to the U.S., historian and New York Times bestselling author. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, that's the whole introduction? Okay.
I can go longer.
No, it's okay.
You told me
First of all, Mr. Ambassador, I want to tell you, the Dworman family, that's my family, must have bought 15 copies of your book, 6 Days of War. And before my father died, he was so taken with this book. He called it cinematic. He just loved this book so much, not just because of the scholarship, but because he felt like he was watching a movie, like what's going on in Cairo, what's going on in Tel Aviv, what's going on in Washington. So I'm thrilled to meet you just for that book alone.
Wow. And the problem is that book I wrote 20 years ago. That's great, Norm. That's good. What have you
and
done
then, of course,
since? That's great. Anyway, I'm delighted to be with both of you and down with the Comedy Cellar. I think my greatest claim to fame is that I'm the uncle of comedian John Rudnitsky.
Oh, you got cut off. The uncle of who?
The comedian John Rudnitsky.
I know John.
That's my true claim to fame. I don't know. I'm John's uncle.
No, I think your true claim to fame is that you were David Rothkopf's roommate, no?
The crazy thing is we were both on Morning Joe 2 days ago. Right. And arguing different sides of the Middle East issue and being interviewed by the daughter of our professor, Mika Brzezinski.
Oh,
can't make that one.
So, all right, let's get to we have a little bit of a bad connection, but we're going to plow through it. So I want to quote the great Michael Oren before I start. Mm-hmm. The Middle East remains a flashpoint of multilateral confrontation, a source of seemingly intractable controversies, a powder keg that the slightest spark could ignite, demanding of its leaders almost constant displays of courage and caution. And further, say the nature of international crises in general and the manner in which human interaction can produce totally unforeseen, unintended results. And, both those quotes rang loud to me as Israel seems to be contemplating what it should do vis-a-vis its answer to Iran's strike. So what's your opinion on all that?
Caution, courage, a little luck would help at this point. No, Israel probably has to respond in some way. You can't have a sovereign state in the Middle East be attacked by 350 projectiles, and some of them were incredibly big, 500 kilograms of TNT. If one of those missiles gotten through, it could have killed thousands of people. You can't have that without having some type of response, because that's the way you retain your deterrence power against all manner of enemies, not just the Iranians. The question is how you respond. Do you respond in kind? Do we fire 350 rockets off at Tehran? I doubt it. You have to avoid, to the greatest degree possible, the chances of triggering a regional conflagration. You have to avoid alienating our newfound Sunni Arab allies. You certainly have to avoid aggravating the United States during a presidential election year and perhaps dragging the United States and other Western allies into that regional conflagration. You have to avoid strengthening the Iranian regime. You want to weaken the Iranian regime. So all these things, you've got to thread any number of needles here in order to make an effective, powerful response to the Iranian attack of last Saturday night. Now, that's the bad news. The good news is that Iran happens to be a target-rich environment. There are many possible targets. The Persian Gulf is lined up with oil facilities, for example. There are numerous vulnerabilities in Iran. There are cyber vulnerabilities. There are economic vulnerabilities. There are certainly social and political vulnerabilities. The regime is sitting on top of a volcano as opposition to its corruption keeps growing every year. You see these protests. So there are many ways that Israel can respond, certainly not in kind, but can actually have that type of deterrent power and send an unequivocal message to other enemies we have in the region.
So let me ask you this, as a kind of a layman here to the issue. I read articles that imply that Iran is at the point where if they chose to, they could assemble an atom bomb. That's one of the things I read quite often. And it seems to me that if they are humiliated or shown to be impotent, that might lead them to the conclusion that, you know, we can't put up with this anymore. Let's just assemble the bomb and that'll be the end of that. They won't strike us after that. Is that a concern?
It is a concern. The Iranians have achieved what's known as threshold capacity, the ability to create an atomic weapon within a matter of weeks, maybe even a matter of days. And not just one bomb, but several bombs. And, you know, that is definitely a concern. But the Iranians have long concluded, and they could always change this calculus, that it is better to have the threshold capacity, the ability to make a bomb, than to hold the bomb itself. Because by having the threshold capacity, you get all the advantages of having the bomb without any of the downsides. So one of the advantages are everybody in the world knows you're a threshold nuclear power. And the Russians make an alliance with you, and the Chinese make an alliance with you, and the BRIC nations invite you in as an honorary member, even though you're the world's largest state sponsor of terror. It doesn't matter. Everyone knows you're a nuclear power. But if you actually have the bomb itself, you may come up against the oft-repeated pledge of the Biden administration and multiple American administrations across the political divide that the United States is committed to preventing Iran from having a nuclear weapon. And the United States has the strategic ability to prevent Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. So if there's a breakout period of 1 week, you know, America could stop that breakout process in a matter of hours from a height of 50,000 feet. And Iranians have nothing that can reach that height using strategic bombers that can drop payloads that could eliminate the Iranian nuclear power program really in a matter of hours. So the Iranians may have to think twice before doing that breakout.
Do we have... Well, I mean, you say they get all the advantages, but one advantage they don't have now is Israel doesn't worry about their bomb as they contemplate bombing Iran. It's such a high-stakes game. Are they sure that they have perfect information that they could prevent this? Is it worth it to risk that? You know, I'm usually a hawk.
Us to risk it or them to risk it? For Israel to risk it or for Iran to risk it?
Is it worth it for Israel to risk triggering that all the chain reaction that you're talking about? And then, of course, maybe Hezbollah then, what the hell, fires all their rockets at the same time. Such a scary, I know you said most of what you want to say, but it's just a very scary chain reaction that could happen. And though I'm usually a hawk, and for instance, Brett Stevens of the New York Times, who's also usually a hawk, has written that he thinks Israel should hold its fire here until it finds the perfect opportunity. Any last thoughts on that?
Well, he's saying until we find the perfect opportunity. I don't know if the perfect opportunity is ever going to present itself. I don't know if the perfect opportunity is ever going to exist in the world. But if that's the case, if Iran were to break out and have a nuclear weapon, then and that would basically obviate any possibility of an Israeli response, then we might as well just pack our bags and move somewhere. Because we'll not be able to respond to any provocations. The provocations are coming because we're dealing with a regime that has as its very raison d'etre our destruction.
Right.
And we'll work to that goal. And they work different ways. You know, the Iranians claim they invented chess. Don't say that to anybody from India. But, the Iranians play chess on multiple levels. And so while they're assiduously building threshold capacity and can make a bomb in a matter of days, they've also been surrounding us on all sides with very large arsenals of rockets. So maybe 150,000 to 170,000 in the rockets in the hands of Hezbollah. There were about 20,000 in the arsenal of Hamas, maybe several thousand or less, but you have rockets in the hands of Shiite militias in Iraq and Syria, rockets in the hands of the Houthis that can reach us here from Yemen. And so what they can begin to do is shoot at us from all different directions, and they have been shooting us at all different directions, and we won't be able to respond because we'll have an Iranian nuclear weapon to our foreheads. And so slowly they can whittle away at our edges, make life here intolerable, and eventually we would disappear. So we can't get caught up in that cycle. We have to break the cycle. How do you break the cycle? By showing the Iranians that it, should they try to embark on that type of, you know, erosion of our existence, we're going to exact a very, very painful price at an earlier stage.
All right, let's move on to something else. I've been reading. Have you ever read Henry Kissinger's book, Diplomacy?
I have. Sure, I have it somewhere right behind me. Yeah.
It's so good. I know people don't like Kissinger, but this book is really good. And as I've been rereading the part about the run up to the Second World War, and there's so many little paragraphs there that remind me of this current situation. So I actually clipped a few of them. One thing it says here is it's about negotiating without leverage. It says the weaker side has the option of playing for time only as against an adversary that considers negotiations as operating according to their own internal logic, an illusion to which the United States has been especially subject. And this made me think that the United States really pulled the rug out from under Israel vis-a-vis trying to get the hostages back, because
totally.
It seemed to me that the only way that
totally.
They would go, the only way they would give the hostages back is to trade the hostages for their lives. And they took the pressure off their lives. So go ahead. You said totally. So go ahead.
Yeah, totally. It's very unfortunate. And I understand why it happened. You know, the political dynamics. You know, Kissinger also said famously or infamously that Israel doesn't have a foreign policy or stick policies. Well, I got news posthumously from Mr. Hughes that America only has domestic politics as well. And you're in the throes of a presidential election, and was sort of neck and neck as of this week with former President Trump, and there are states and they have progressive populations and other populations who may take strong exception to policies toward the Gaza conflict, et cetera. This is all very much known, but the upshot of it was messages that kept on coming out of Washington that Israel was dehumanizing the Palestinians, bombing the Palestinians indiscriminately, reacting over the top, purposely starving the Palestinians, and strong intimations that the Biden administration didn't recognize the legitimacy of Israel's current government, distinguishing between the government and the people of Israel. All these messages are being heard not just by Israelis, but by Mr. Sinwar in his tunnel in South Gaza. And what he would conclude, I think quite logically, is that all he has to do is hold on for another week, 2-3 weeks at most, create a situation where Israel is going to be killing Palestinians because they're being used as human shields by Hamas. More Palestinians are dying. And eventually, Mr. Sinwar will conclude that there will be a break between Israel and the United States, and the United States will impose a ceasefire on Israel, and a ceasefire that will be permanent and unconditional. And America began taking steps in that direction with twin resolutions in the Security Council, which was the first time distinguished between the release of Hamas and the release of hostages and the ceasefire. Before, they had always been conditional, one and the other. So that's another indication to the Hamas that all it has to do is hold on. So in that situation, why would Sinwar give up hostages? Why would he give up what he considers assets in return for anything less than the end of the war? Why would he give them up for a 6-week ceasefire? It's not going to do him any good. At the end of 6 weeks, Israel's just going to resume the war. And so the American policy has been to greatly diminish Hamas's interest in a temporary ceasefire that will release at least some of the hostages. And that is why Hamas has rejected again and again any suggestion of a further hostage for temporary ceasefire deal. Apparently the talks have broken down completely today. If the United States had said something different, I think, Norm, saying, we're not crazy about the way Israel has conducted this war. We're concerned about the civilian casualties. We're concerned about the humanitarian situation. But we are absolutely standing four square behind Israel in its determination to uproot Hamas from Gaza, including from Rafah. We might have seen a hostage deal.
Now, what do you attribute this to? I mean, you don't have to go to the Fletcher School to understand like a schoolyard logic here that you can't negotiate without leverage. Is it that our experts don't understand what was going on, or is it just that the presidential election trumps everything.
Yeah, I think the elections play a very big role. I think there's deep personal concern on the part of President Biden and his immediate advisors about the humanitarian situation in Gaza. But I go deeper. I worked with all these individuals, from the then Vice President Biden to his chief of policy staff, who was Tony Blinken, to the head of policy planning, the State Department, Jake Sullivan. These are all people I worked with 10, 15 years ago, and they're now running the show. And I know them to be deeply committed to Israel, to Israel's security, to the historic alliance between Israel and the United States. I understand that. But they also come from a certain worldview. And this is, you know, here I tread lightly because I'm not actually not a citizen of the United States anymore. I don't vote. I never want to get involved in internal American politics. But over the years, I've identified what I would call a democratic worldview, which is different than a Republican worldview. And in that democratic worldview, there's a deep reverence for international institutions like the UN. And this administration will quote UN sources all the time. I can't remember the last time I heard a Republican quote the UN about everything. So it's a deep sort of internationalism. It very much reflects the educational background of so many of these people. They all come from the same universities. There is a recoiling from military power, not necessarily, you know, not subscribing to the old von Clausewitzian adage that war is diplomacy by other means. War is the failure of diplomacy. It's not a tool of diplomacy. So they would Kissinger would certainly have a problem with them. And they don't necessarily understand military power. None of them have, I can't point to anybody outside of National Security Council spokesman John Kirby who actually served in the military and certainly who have actually fought in a war. So that, I think that whole world is very alien to them. What it means to fight in a densely populated, totally booby-trapped environment that is Gaza, in which you're fighting not just an enemy that's hiding behind the civilian population, but actually using the landscape as a shield, because underneath the battlefield is another battlefield of 450 miles of tunnels. It's never encountered by the American military, much by even the military military. So I understand them not being able to understand. I can understand them their lack of comprehension. There is I don't want to use the word obsession, but certainly a fixation on the Palestinian issue as it relates to Israel. When Palestinians were being massacred by the Syrians during the Syrian civil war, when Syrian tanks were rumbling through the Yarmouk refugee camp outside Damascus, I didn't see a lot of people being very upset in Washington. I didn't even see the degree of distress expressed over the situation in Gaza. I don't see equaled even by the withdrawal from Afghanistan and the abandonment of America's allies there, or even by the massacre of 500,000 Syrians during the Syrian civil war. I didn't see major tears being shed there. Over the Palestinians, it's a separate situation. And that's being played out across the United States, not just in decision-making halls in Washington, where the Palestinian issue is becoming a defining issue of the American left and major parts of the Democratic Party. It may even be a major issue in the 2024 elections. So all this is playing into the shifts in the administration's policy. And it's a pretty big shift from the first week after the October 7th massacre, the historic, truly historic speech of President Biden. I want you to know we all stood in front of our television sets and cried. We had tears streaming down our cheeks. Decades I've been involved in U.S.'s relations, both as a researcher and as a practitioner, and I'd never heard anything like that speech. I'd never heard anything like Tony Blinken's first visit here, where he went on for 20 minutes about what it meant for him as a Jew to witness the horrors of October 7th. And, you know, I remember thinking about Henry Kissinger, how Henry Kissinger would admit publicly he was Jewish, maybe with a gun to his head. Right. It was like there was Tony Blinken talking about his Jewish identity and the Holocaust experiences of his father, his stepfather, rather, and what this meant to him. That was also deeply moving. But I was also keenly aware of two sentences that appeared both in the president's speech and in the Secretary of State's remarks was, we expect Israel, as it prosecutes this war, to conform to international humanitarian law. And I remember thinking to myself, okay, we're up against the clock. And that clock is ticking, starting now. And and eventually, Tony Blinken would come out and say several times that entirely too many Palestinians have been killed, which is a strange locution because it suggests that there would have been a number that would have been okay. And maybe in somebody's mind, there would have been a number that would have been okay. But it also it bespeaks a certain worldview where in a war, too many civilians have been killed. And, you know, any if you know the history of America's recent wars, whether in Iraq, Afghanistan, against ISIS, the ratio of combatant to civilian deaths was many times higher than what it is in Gaza. But that is that doesn't figure in either.
Right. Well, I have this feeling, and it's a wide issue that I'm talking about, which is the psychology of it all, that somehow people don't view Israel as a real country. You know, just the displaced people within the country itself, as I understand it, proportionately are as big as major American cities. And America would not forfeit any of its cities, even without a single person dying. If Manhattan Island had to clear out because of missiles coming in, even if it didn't kill a single person, we would take care of it. And again, to this Kissinger book, he talks about how the world felt guilty about the Treaty of Versailles, and that eroded the psychological basis for defending it. And I feel like as the world is psychologically moved somehow that Israel is not a good guy in this conflict, it erodes the psychological basis for them defending, for them supporting Israel defending itself.
Like a hit, is that right? Some button there. I can't take issue with it. For me, the realization is a certain way starker. Because I've been involved in public diplomacy, defending Israel for many, many years, and we do a lousy job of it, I got to tell you. We kind of be very, Israelis can be very contemptuous of world opinion, not important what the non-Jews think, it's what the Jews do. It's a common adage here. We're bad at it, but at the end of the day, we are the Jewish state. And the Jewish state is always going to be judged by a different standard. I just mentioned, you know, the fact that the combatant to civilian fatality ratio in Iraq and Syria and Afghanistan was between 4-1 and 9-1, whereas in Gaza it's closer to 1-1. And so it's a completely different standard. I don't see the United States being accused of genocide, right, or of reacting over the top or bombing indiscriminately. And behind many of the accusations, and I say this with deep regret, I hear the resonances of classic anti-Semitic tropes. Just a small example, the Hamas statistic of 32,000 Palestinians dead is repeated constantly by American leaders, including by the president, where even if you were to take that number at face value, we all know it's inflated here, it doesn't matter. Say 32,000 Palestinians have been dead. And from my perspective, one Palestinian dead is one Palestinian dead too many. It's a tragedy. Okay, so understand that. But having said that, Israel's killed about 14,000 Palestinian terrorists. You deduct that from the 32, and you deduct several thousand, at least, Palestinians who have been killed by the 30% of Palestinian rockets that fall short and fall in Gaza itself, like the Al-Ahli hospital. And then just the thousands of Palestinians over the course of 4-6 months who would die just of natural causes. And then Hamas will turn around and say that 78% of these 32,000 are children, which is statistically impossible, but nobody questions it. Why doesn't anybody question the Hamas claim that we killed children? Because a classic anti-Semitic trope is that Jews kill children. It's the massacre of the innocents from the New Testament. It's the blood libel. And I hear resonance of anti-Semitic tropes all the time. And also because, you know, I often interview with people who are a lot less amenable than you are in, you know, the BBC and the Canadian broadcasting company. And a very typical question with how many children does the IDF, how Palestinian children does the IDF have to kill before it's satisfied? Or aren't you happy to kill Palestinian children? In that, that's right out of the 13th century.
Well, I you would know better than me. This I know the blood libel is real. I question among a people who barely know who the vice president is, how many of them are really aware of that trope? But maybe it filters down somehow, or maybe it's just this intersectional worldview that the West and white people and colonialists kill people all. You know, there's so many issues going on. But whatever the origin is, I agree with you 100% that that's what's going on. This genocide charge. Now, let me just shift to America for a second. The genocide charge, more than anything else, disturbs me greatly. First of all, it's such an outrageous charge. And just to tell the listeners, just to give an example, I've said it before on the show, the Hutus killed 700,000 to 1 million Tutsis in 100 days, basically with machetes and their bare hands. That's what, you know, as the radio blasts were exhorting them to go out and kill their neighbors. That's what a genocide looks like. Doesn't have a one-to-one ratio. And certainly there was no genocide with both hands tied behind your back, where Israel has the firepower to commit any genocide it wants and has only killed 30,000 people. God forbid, I don't mean to make light of the number, but compared to what they could do in the most densely populated place on earth. So having said that, what worries me, even after this war is over, is that as the Atlantic said, although I said it first, Pearl, the golden age for being Jewish in America is over, that there's a reversion to the mean of kind of anti-Semitism that my father described from when he was young, and this genocide charge cancels out the Holocaust in some way that I think is a relief to people. Enough with the Holocaust. We did it to them, the West did it. Now we can say they did it to them, and both sides are gone. And I've described it, it's like acid rain. I have three young children who don't know the first thing about politics. And this is acid rain on their psychology. It is affecting them. They are aware that being Jewish is an issue in a way that was simply not the case when I was a young Jewish kid in the same neighborhood that my kids are growing up. And this will be, I'm worried, a much more lasting legacy of this war than what we're seeing. What are your thoughts about
this
war?
It's become much more widespread. We've been dealing with charges of genocide for a very long time. And and it's true, my father probably had the same experiences of your father, you know, sort of locking themselves on a Sunday while everyone was out listening to Father Coughlin on the radio, sprouting anti-Semitism. I'm not convinced that that anti-Semitism is worse than it was. And say when we grew up, listen, I grew up in a working class Sicilian neighborhood, and I experienced anti-Semitism pretty much every day and had big influence on me, influence on my moving to Israel. I get, you know, someone beat you up and telling you you're a Christ killer, you want to be able to defend yourself. But what October 7th did was to remove the veil from anti-Semitism and to go beyond that, to actually endow aspects of it with virtue. And that hasn't happened for a very long time. That hasn't happened, certainly in this, in the United States, hasn't happened, and perhaps even not even in the 1930s. There was a level of anti-Semitism which was still whispered around tables and not, you know, not broadcast along with Father Coughlin. He was sort of he was an exception.
Can I just interrupt you there for 1 second just to say that Tucker Carlson gave a speech or a podcast recently where he was, and that was reminiscent of Father Coughlin. Of the Jews are responsible for the persecution of Christians. I looked up some of his speeches. He was almost as if Tucker had investigated this.
Amazing,
and decided to pick up
Israel
the same
has the only
effective
growing Christian
line
population in the entire Middle East. And at a time when Christian populations are being decimated throughout the Middle East, here it's growing. And Israeli Arab Christians are per capita more affluent and better educated than Israeli Jews. So the whole thing is a libel. But it's true. So the veil has been lifted from anti-Semitism. It wasn't like people woke up on October 7th and said, "Oh, wow, I'm an anti-Semite." What they did was they could feel that they could give voice to those feelings, to those prejudices, that hatred, and not only not be penalized for it, but in certain ways be valorized by it. I mean, just that is the big difference. And that's a new world. I don't know if we can stick that genie back in the bottle. I don't know whether we actually have gone through a sea change. Now, I have a Substack called Clarity, and Clarity is my great goal is to get a clear view. This war has given us clarity on a lot of issues. One of them is on the nature and extent of anti-Semitism. Clarity. Sometimes clarity plays in our favor. You know, I'm been asked by Columbia alumni to respond to today's testimony of the Columbia president, Shafiq, testified in Congress on the same issue that felled Harvard's president and Penn's president several months ago. About and what was interesting about that testimony was that it ostensibly was about anti-Semitism and anti-Israel fervor on campuses, but it was really about the soul of America. It was about something very deep. And it reminded me of the Dreyfus trials of the 1890s. And I've written about this on my Substack in an article called Mein Kulturkampf, because it seems to me in the 1890s also, the Dreyfus trial was ostensibly about anti-Semitism, but it was really about the soul of France. And that for some reason, Jews find themselves on the cutting edge of these culture comps again and again. And it's happened throughout history. It happened in the Roman and Greek world as well. It's just a strange destiny that we have. And it's being played out in America, because when people say Palestine in America today, they mean many things. They mean socialism. They mean LGBT rights, strangely, because there are no LGBT rights in Palestine, or women's rights. They mean anti-colonialism. They mean anti-nationalism. They mean many different things when they say Palestine. And that doesn't necessarily refer to even the geographic Palestine. They say, you know, from the river to the sea, but the river to the sea actually doesn't include Gaza. Look on a map. The river stops north of Gaza. It's, and even Israel's come to mean different things. Israel's come to mean traditionalism. It's come to mean a certain brand of maybe of conservatism. It's come to mean patriotism, religion, family, different things. So there's a great cultural struggle going around these terms. And what is ostensibly about Israel and Palestinians is about something much deeper and wider. Sorry.
You got cut off there for a second, the very end. So let me go back to this Democratic worldview. You left the ambassadorship, the very that's end, how you put yeah. it, in 2013, is that correct? So you dealt with the Obama administration. And so I was looking at Obama's memoir. And I was reading his, I have it here, his, the way he described some of the history of the Arab-Israeli negotiations. And it left me slack-jawed. I couldn't believe the way he put it. I'll read a little bit of it to you to get your comment. He says, and I'll read it maybe a few sentences at a time. After Netanyahu was defeated in the 1999 election, his more liberal successor, Ehud Barak, made efforts to establish a broader peace in the Middle East. So far, so good. Including outlining a two-state solution that went further than any previous Israeli proposal. Arafat demanded more concessions, however, and talks collapsed in recrimination. This is how he puts the way, you know, the demanding the total right of return, refusing to entertain any end of the conflict, and walking out without a counterproposal. He just chalks it off to, you know, Arafat demanded more concessions and talks collapse. And it says, and then meanwhile, one day in September 2000, now September is before the meetings in Taba, right, which were in December, if I have my timeline right. It says, but in September 2000, Likud party leader Ariel Sharon led a group of Israeli legislators on a deliberately provocative and highly publicized visit to one of Islam's holiest sites in a stunt to assert Israel's claim over the wider territory. Obviously, he's setting up why the second intifada started. He blames it on Sharon's stunt, ignoring the fact that the most far-reaching proposals came afterwards. I mean, I could go on with this. How do you explain that kind of tendentious? I mean, I don't even think it's a defensible narrative of what went on. How do you explain that? Where's he coming from?
Arafat simply picked up and left. And Clinton said to him famously, you know, I'm a failure and you've made me one. And
It clashes with every memoir of anybody who was in the room, including Nabil Ammer, who was a Palestinian who wrote a letter complaining about the fact that Arafat didn't deal in good faith.
September. Temple Mount also happens to be the holiest site in Israel, in Judaism. It's the third holiest site in Islam. And, you know, the notion that a Jew visiting the holiest site in Judaism should trigger a terrorist war that will claim 1,000 Israeli lives is a bit of a stretch. But let me say, there's nothing that is surprising about that for me. You know, I wrote a memoir of my time in Washington called Ally, and there's a chapter there which turned to be quite controversial. It's called Obama One-on-One. And this is going back to 2008, 2009, where nobody really knew who this person was. He was very, very cipher-like, and he'd only spent 2 years in the Senate. And so I sat down in a truly, you know, sort of academic way and decided to study who this person was. I read everything he had ever written several times, every interview, every speech. And I came to some very fundamental conclusions about his worldview. His worldview, yes, was a democratic worldview, which included respect for international institutions, a strong feeling about Palestinians, a reticence to use military force, and unfamiliarity with military force. All of that was there, plus ideas that were taken directly off most, you know, your typical Ivy League campus. There was nothing particularly outrageous by any of this, or certainly alien to me, because I had spent a lot of time teaching in these campuses and studying in these campuses. And I say this not, you know, in any self-aggrandizement, but I reached a point where on almost no occasion did he surprise me. And there were, you know, there are many people that surprised many other people, but didn't surprise me. It just fit in with the worldview very well. And which, by the way, was a big, big asset for an ambassador. I could say with certainty that the president was going to do a certain thing. I'll just give a random example. This is actually after I was ambassador. I was already in government. I ran for Knesset and I was the deputy to the prime minister. And in 2016, Israel President Obama suggested a 10-year memorandum of understanding to give military aid every year to Israel, and with a significant increase. And I said to the prime minister, this was in September of 2016, I said, well, you can sign this thing, but I guarantee you that come December, when the Security Council meets to discuss settlements, the President Obama will condemn Israel on the settlements. You should know this. So this was his MO, to give us aid, but then to condemn us. And Netanyahu accepted the 10-year memorandum of understanding with Obama. And 2 months later, Obama condemned us in the Security Council. That doesn't make me a prophet. It just means someone who did his homework.
So where's he coming? Can we talk about it bluntly? Where does his worldview come from? He doesn't seem to have a problem with Jews.
You know, by the way, I had a very high regard for him as a person, as an intellect. He's an extraordinary human being in so many ways. And here you are in the comedy club. He has one of the best comedic timing of any human being I've ever met. He is really funny. He's fantastic.
He's fantastic. Fantastic. Those correspondents.
He's outrageously gifted as an individual. But his worldview is very different than certainly that of many Israelis. And we had to respect that. This is the person who the American people had elected twice and quite decisively. And so you deal with that. There are certain benefits to having a leader who is predictable and one who is not predictable.
Sure. Can I just push back for one little second on Obama, just because I get a worldview and I understand like a third world oriented view and an anti-colonialist worldview, but that's not the same thing to me as misstating the facts in your memoir. He knows certainly that it wasn't just that Arafat demanded more concessions. Yeah. As a matter of fact, it's good. I just remembered. There's a story in the New York Times from, I think it's 2014, maybe right after you left, where the Kerry framework had fallen apart. And it says, in a March meeting with Mr. Abbas in the Oval Office, Mr. Obama tried to sell him on Mr. Kerry's framework. The Palestinian leader, officials said, did not respond, preferring to reiterate his rejection of the Israeli demand that the Palestinians recognize Israel as a Jewish state. Quote, "The president was skeptical about a deal after that meeting," the official said. "Abbas was more comfortable pivoting to public grievance than focusing on a private negotiation." So he had his own little taste of exactly what they went through. And yet
it's gotta fit
he pretends it didn't happen.
Once you get the worldview, everything, you know, you're going to get a couple of square pegs trying to get into that round worldview, and you're going to have to bash them in with a hammer. And that's what you see. You can almost hear the hammer bashing here. You know, it can't be that you know, Arafat just picked up and left the Camp David talks in the summer of 2000. There had to be some kind of differences over opinion, and the talks collapsed. The talks collapsed. Not that Arafat brought them down. And there has to be some kind of cause and effect, because it cannot be that the Palestinian Authority, led by Yasser Arafat, had been planning an armed revolt before October 2000, and just happened to be ready with this massive terrorist onslaught at the beginning of October, because Ariel Sharon visited the holiest site in Judaism. It can't be. There has to be something that's going to get the Palestinians off the hook. And that's what binds both of these stories that you just read me, is that it's letting the Palestinians off the hook. And part of the worldview that I mentioned earlier was this fixation on the Palestinians. And also, I would go further. Who are the Palestinians? They are victims. They are the quintessential victims. And in that democratic worldview, victimhood is also endowed with virtue. And a certain amount of their type of that also has got to evoke certain classic anti-Semitic tropes. But it's they are the immaculate victim of rather, what can I say, less than immaculate Jews. So these are deep-seated trends, and that have many causes. One of them is just being on an American campus. From the 1980s onward, you would imbibe all of these ideas. And there are people who would say that President Obama got them from his pastor in Chicago, who was notoriously anti-Israel / anti-Semitic. Many ways. I never found him remotely anti-Semitic, and I didn't think he was
Reverend
even anti-Israel,
Wright.
By the way. He just had a different concept of Israel. I used to always think that he used to say, I admire the Israel of Golda Meir and Moshe Dayan. And I didn't want to remind him that this was an Israel that was very prejudiced against Jews from Eastern origins, prejudiced against women, not very nice to its Arab population. There was even that was kind of a campus image of Israel in the 1960s. Israel today, you know, for everything we've gone through, and in spite of this very right wing government, which I will not, you know, elements of which I cannot defend, is far more democratic than it was in the 1960s, far more open, far more accepting, and you know, has come a very long way. But you'd have to actually have an understanding of the realities of this country to reach that conclusion.
So, I could go on and on about Obama, but the on the issue of people, you know, kind of massaging the facts to fit as pegs into their own worldview. What's your view on the settlements? You sound like you are sympathetic to the settlements. Is that right?
I would say I'm sympathetic to most settlements. The settlements we tend to lump them all together, settlements. 85% of the settlements are in blocks adjacent to the 1967 border. And in any negotiations, and I participated in negotiations, the assumption is that Israel was going to retain those blocks, that we may have to compensate the Palestinians with other land swaps. We're going to retain them because those settlements thicken out Israel's border, which pre-67 were 8 miles wide, and they were undefensible. And that's why the United States put that line into Resolution 242 from 1967, that Israel should have to have defensible borders. So that's one aspect of the settlements. 85% of them, these are the big communities along the border. There is also certainly a religious and ideological dimension to it. You know, I'm sitting here in Jaffa, and the same justification for my presence as a Jew in Jaffa is the same presence, same justification that a Jew will use living in an outlying settlement in Samaria or Judea, in the settlements of, you know, Beth El or Shiloh, and or Eli. because we believe that this land is the ancient homeland of the Jewish people. People of very religious believe that God gave us this land, but it's certainly our ancient homeland. The exact same justification. You can't divide them. In fact, the guy living in Shiloh, in Hebron, in Bethlehem, has much more justification than I do, because Tel Aviv is not in the Bible. Haifa is not in the Bible, but those places are. Okay, so they actually have more. They actually say, look at the Bible, they have more justification. So it's very difficult for a Jewish state so constituted to tell a Jew that she or he can't live in their ancient homeland. Think about that. That's like if you'd say, like, taking a Native American and saying, listen, you can't live on sacred Sioux land. You know, it's beyond, you can't live there because it's too problematic. No one would say that there, and no one would say it here. The only reason for in any way qualifying the Jews' right to the land of Israel is that there's another people who also claim that right. And that you don't have to actualize all rights. It doesn't mean you have to make a settlement in downtown Ramallah or downtown Tulkarm or Jenin. Clearly, there's another people there who claim the same right. And it's if we're ever to end this conflict or simply even get to a better status quo of the conflict, we're going to have mutual recognition of that rights. Our problem is that, you know, what I just said, I think is acceptable to a very large number of Israelis. It is not acceptable to any Palestinian leader I've ever known or read about. As a matter of fact, I participated in the last round of negotiations with the Palestinians, and I'll never forget what one of their lead negotiators told me, because it made me realize I wasted 20 years in university studying all this. All you had to do was hear this one thing. It was worth 20 years of American education. And he said to me, you want us to recognize you as the Jewish state. That is, recognize you as an indigenous people endowed with an inalienable right to self-determination in your homeland. But you must know that in asking us to do that, you're asking us to negate our identity. And suddenly I realized all this talk about territory and borders and Jerusalem and settlements and security is all crap. What it's really about is that the negation of our identity is essential to Palestinian identity. They wake up in the morning and they're Palestinians, not because, you know, because they're not us. We have a whole different source of identity as Jews and Israelis. And that ending this conflict in a way that really ends the conflict would be a type of identity suicide for the Palestinians. And that's what they were basically saying. That's what this leader was saying to me. And that is why you will not find one, and I stress not one Palestinian leader ever, who will sign onto the formula of the United States, which is two states for two peoples. Because no Palestinian leader has ever recognized the existence of a Jewish people with an historic roots in this land. All the, you know, archaeology stuff we dig up is all fabricated. There never was a temple, never a first temple, never a second temple. And they'll never sign on a dotted line that says end of claims or end of conflicts, because they see a two-state solution as an interim solution before the refugees return and, you know, turn Israel into a de facto Palestinian state. So that's their position.
So let me ask you. Yeah. I just so people listening who hear me not jumping in, we have a bad connection. You do eventually come through and I'm hearing, but it's hard for me to not that I want to be rude and interrupt you, but from time to time, people will notice that I don't jump in like I normally do. But let me just ask about a question. I understand it's the ancient Jewish homeland. Two questions. First of all, doesn't that become extinguished at some point in time? What if there were people there before the Jews? I mean, that's my first question, is that doesn't that become extinguished when another people has lived there for many, many years? You can't just come back and reclaim it. And number one, number two, this recent annexation that we read about a few weeks ago, was that in the part of the West Bank that everybody expects would stay Israel in a settlement, or was that jutting out into territory that would probably,
I don't know,
that
of
many
annexation.
People would want to be Palestinian land?
I don't know. It's news to me, honestly. You mean a program to build settlements, or, you know, there's no annexation.
There was a big news story about
to build a number of settlement houses.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. You're right. I didn't mean to use the word annexation. Absolutely. But they took land.
Like maybe expropriation.
I don't know what the term is. I can look it up. But you know what I'm referring to.
Okay. Expropriation.
Expropriation, yes.
If it was state land, not state land. Yeah, I know. This is these are sources of great controversy. Yeah, yeah. The controversy in Israel also. It's not just in the world. I gave you a general overview of the settlements, the security justification and the ideological religious justification. It just is. But I also said something that would be very controversial. It would probably put me on the left side of the spectrum in Israel by saying I recognize that there's another people here that have, you know, have those rights. And by the way, you know, if the Jebusites and the Hittites were to show up tomorrow and lay claim to Jerusalem, Jerusalem was a Jebusite system, maybe we'd have an issue with the Jebusites. They don't happen to be around anymore. But one of the reasons that the Jews are around after 4,000 years is because of our connection to this land. And the connection to the land is actually instrumental to our identity. It's not incidental. And in any section of the land, the Bible, beginning at the very beginning of the Bible says, I'm going to make a covenant with you guys, and I'm going to seal that covenant with this land. And, you know, we'll be celebrating Passover in a couple of days, and it's all about getting out of slavery and coming into this land eventually. And this is where we get freedom. And it's, to me, it's actually not just an ideological one. I think that this is the only country where Jews as Jews can be completely free. Because freedom for me means accepting responsibility. And only here we can accept responsibility for ourselves as Jews.
Yeah. I'm less comfortable. I'm not comfortable with the religious justifications. I understand the historical realities. I'm offended when they don't want to admit that the Jews have a history there. But you know, anyway. All right, that's my own theory on it. Just before I let you go, I don't really understand the identity erasure. Someone else told me that. I see it as having to agree to what is a national humiliation, to accept this 22%. Is so humiliating, especially given the atmosphere that is cultural and the way they're raised, that they prefer the status quo. The status quo is preferable, in my opinion, to agreeing to this humiliation where they finally had to take this small piece of land. That's just the way I see it. Maybe you don't agree.
I don't think it's a decision that's easy for the Palestinians. It isn't.
You don't disagree.
The question is, at some point, do they want to emerge from victimhood and take responsibility for themselves as a sovereign nation and not just as the victims?
Yes.
Zionism's great victory, I believe, was to really take the Jews out of victimhood. Now, we still talk about the Holocaust, certainly, and you know, you can visit Yad Vashem when you come here, but we don't see ourselves as victims anymore. And I think that's absolutely crucial for moving forward in history. That's how you get you can harness the past, but you're not prisoner to the past. And the Zionist movement had to make some very painful decisions too. Palestine, as it was defined by the British Mandate and defined by the League of Nations, included what is today Gaza and the West Bank and all of Jordan. And when the British began to chop that up and made a kingdom called Transjordan and then lopped Gaza off and mostly lopped the West Bank off, Israel was left with the Zionist movement was left with a small part of what they regarded as Palestine, too. And it was a very painful decision. It broke apart the Zionist movement in the 1920s. As a matter of fact, the Likud is a descendant of that party that rejected the British, you know, carving up of Palestine. Right. It wanted it all. They're saying was that there are two banks to the Jordan, the West Bank and the East Bank. But labor Zionism made the very hard decision of accepting that reality because they realized, listen, if we want to just get out of this idea of being stateless and have our own, you know, sovereign nation, then we're going to have to make some very painful compromises. And the Zionist movement made it again and again. And they did it in 1947 with the partition resolution. The sad history of it is that every time the Palestinians reject that two-state solution, the next deal gives them actually less land every time.
Well,
I didn't. No, you're
cut
here.
Off there.
I'm not going anywhere.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, you know, I'm sorry with the bad connection again. But, you know, as what you're saying, yeah, I just brought up one of the things. So talking about the Democratic worldview and all this stuff and you know, Thomas Friedman, who apparently has the president's ear, he had a line in his column months ago where he talks about the Palestinians reaching, quote, dream of independence in their homeland in a state next to Israel. And this is this goes to what you're saying from that worldview. They overlay on the Palestinians the psychology. They're dreaming of a homeland peaceful side by side next to Israel. If only that were the case, but more they'd have point, it, right?
Gaza is, I mean, I got some bad news for Tom Friedman. Gaza actually is in Palestine, and they have an independent state there. And they did not live in peace.
Yeah.
They did not. Okay. So the West Bank. The argument doesn't quite hold. I wish it were true. Right now, 85% of the Palestinians in the West Bank support Hamas, and they are not advocates of the two-state solution, believe me, by any stretch. So, you know, it doesn't mean, though, that we can despair, that we can give up trying to reach a solution. And I personally believe that there are other venues, other paths we can take. There are federal solutions. There are cantonment on the Swiss model solutions. There is extended autonomy. I'm not here to plug my book, but I have a new book out. It's called 2048, which is interesting. It's my vision of Israel on its 100th birthday. 2048 is our 100th birthday, but the book is in Hebrew, it's in Arabic, it's in English. It's all in one book. Plug it. Okay, here it is. 2048.
Plug it by all means. I'm sorry we didn't say to the top of the show.
About peace process. It's about healthcare. It's about education. It's about relations with America, relations with Jews, and relations with our Arab citizens. But it's the largest chapter is about the peace process. And in that, I really discuss my own experience. I started off as an advisor to Yitzhak Rabin in the early 90s. And I've gone through this whole process, you know, for over 30 years, and I've reached some fundamental conclusions. And one of the conclusions is that this constant harping on the two-state solution actually does a disservice not just to Israelis, it's a disservice to Palestinians, because it's preventing creative thinking on other ways of moving forward. And that formula has failed again and again and again. And yet people seem very beholden to it. And I know that there are people up in the Democratic Party that understand what I'm saying and believe what I'm saying and wish we could move other ways. But, you know, again, as Kissinger said about Israel, you know, we don't have a foreign policy. All we have is domestic policy.
Yeah. Well, I think the Democrat, I can't imagine a pro-Israel Democratic Party in 2032, let alone 2028. I think Biden is the last gasp of it. All right, sir. It's been an absolute pleasure to meet you finally after 20 years of wishing that I could meet you.
From
I know you
nephew,
came to the Comedy Cellar
nephew,
one time.
John
I think
Rudnitsky.
You did. And I wasn't.
I was a great comedian.
But didn't you? Did you ever come
I
there?
Came to see
I
him.
Thought that I heard that you came one time. You never came.
I came to see him. He is a very.
You came
very
to see him.
Guy.
Okay.
By the way, it's terrific.
So
I love him very much.
So when you come to New York next, I hope you'll come again. And I want to thank you very much for your time. And I'm going to get your book immediately on Kindle. I'm assuming it's on Kindle as well. I read everything on Kindle now.
Thank
and
you so much
be
for
safe
night,
over there. And thank you very much for your time.